All right, everybody, it is time for another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. But before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy to understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it is that dang time, guys. It is the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce Paul, joined by my trusty, my notorious compadre, Mr. Pizza Mind. And we're also joined today, funny enough, by another person who goes by a moniker, another single name gentleman, just like Pizza Mind. Before we introduce our special guest, Pete, how we doing?
I'm doing great over here. We finally have some relief here in Texas. Things are cooling off. We got the thunderstorms coming in.
You sent all the heat over to California.
Yeah, it's your turn. So if we're turning up the fire, go ahead and bring it.
I love it. Well, we're gonna be speaking with the VP of payments at a not so little company anymore called Fireblocks. I remember first starting to use Fireblocks when it was just maybe 10 or 20 people working at the company. And now it's a unicorn, like a billion-dollar company in Tel Aviv, Israel, who is doing just about the best thing in terms of securing cryptocurrency, through wallets, multi-party computation. This is a fantastic company that has my full support, my full endorsement. No, this is not a very paid episode.
Yeah. You don't give that very often to anyone.
I don't think I've ever really given it to anybody on this show. That's true. So I'm excited to speak with Goldie, and we're going to bring him on right now. The one man wrecking crew, Goldie, how we doing?
Hey, great. Great to be here. Thank you, Bryce. And thank you, Pizza Man, Aaron, for having me. I'll take all the compliments on behalf of Fireblocks. I will say that it's obviously, all thanks to my team. Actually, no, that's wrong. I'll tell you more. We've just joined Fireblocks in the last 7 months for an acquisition. But oh, wow. I totally agree with you. It's one of the best companies definitely in Israel and I think in the crypto space altogether. Right now, about 560 employees. So thank you for being a longtime supporter.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you guys have just done everything right. You guys come from, a security background, and it's not one of those sort of companies that moves fast and breaks things. And that's especially the kind of company you want who is, manning, if you will, the private keys and the cryptocurrency security. But before we get into what Fireblocks does and all that good stuff, I didn't know about this acquisition, that's how you came to be. So tell us what you were building prior to working at Fireblocks and what the acquisition kind of looked like.
Right. So, great question. I mean, look, I think that maybe it's important to understand my personal background is not necessarily, well, no one's background is really crypto because it's crypto's revenue, right? Before Fireblocks, I spent about 4.5 years actually in a crypto company called First Digital. And we were doing payments on digital assets. We were actually one of the companies behind Facebook's or Meta's DM project, if you remember that, that amazing stablecoin that never saw the light of day. And we were one of the companies that actually were working on the tech of that and working with other great companies in the space to do payments. And luckily enough, in February of this year, we got acquired by Fireblocks, which has been nothing short of amazing. Again, I don't want to speak too many praises on behalf of the company that I work for, but I really feel like we're honored to be here. And this was a very big journey for us. So I know this is a crypto podcast and not maybe a entrepreneurial journey podcast, but having, as you guys know as well, because you run crypto businesses, running a business in crypto is, you know, every year is like 7 years in another business, right? And we ran our business for about 4.5 years, and we started it in 2017, right? So I was very fortunate to have great co-founders with me, and we raised $21 million of seed funding in 2017, right where there was, you know, I remember when we raised funds, Bitcoin was at 2,500, I think, and by the time that we really started the company, it was already probably like 10K. That was the time that everyone thought, okay, you know, everyone has to buy Bitcoin. You would go in a cab driver would talk to you about Bitcoin, right? and basically it was easy raising funds. Like you didn't have to be a genius to make money out of crypto back then, but we were growing super fast. We became within, I think, 6 months from 2 people to about 70 people. We were profitable. Everything was amazing. Then the crypto winter came in, you know, 2018, and it became a bit colder in 2019 to some extent. And we had to let go of 63 people, which is like 90% of the company.
Wow.
And we said, yeah, this is my first rodeo. Happy to talk about my background later, but I was under the, let's say, impression that obviously if I want to continue this company, and I'm a big believer in blockchain and in finance, we need cash, right? And if you need cash and you're not profitable anymore, then you need to stop burning cash. And we've let go of 63 people, 90% of the company, went through like a really focused exercise, really nailed what we believe is the next big use case in crypto, which is payments. And we were very lucky to work with Facebook and other large companies back then when they had the DM project, like, you know, Uber and Shopify and Spotify and checkout.com and all those companies. And by the time we've set up our product, it was like DeFi summer and, you know, COVID and a finance bubble and a blockchain hype and everything together. And we were very lucky to be at that crossroad. And we, you know, after raising $21 million, being profitable, crypto winter, selling, firing 90% of your workforce, then reigniting the company, getting to this place where suddenly we got 5 acquisition offers. And for me, choosing Fireblocks was a no-brainer because I personally know the founders for more than 20 years. We spent more than 5 years together in intelligence forces here in Israel. And I was also, we were also Fireblocks' first client and design partner. So I know the team, I know the DNA, it was a perfect fit. And that's how the acquisition eventually came to be. Sorry if that was a long answer to that question.
No, that's an amazing story. And you're right, entrepreneurship and crypto do go hand in hand. And it's amazing to see things really just kind of gel together. While you were customer number one, I think I was customer number 13 at Fireblocks. And it's been amazing to see them grow. And if you're listening to this episode and you've never heard of Fireblocks, they're an institutional grade custodian, similar to an Anchorage or a Coinbase custody, that's really working with large institutions, hedge funds, banks, venture capital groups, and solving the problem of not just custody, but transactions. And that was what I loved most about Fireblocks. is it took that absolute terror of making a transaction with a large amount of money out of the equation. Because before Fireblocks, you know, you're copying and pasting an address, you're praying it was never mistyped, you're praying you highlighted the entire thing, you're hoping that you don't have some kind of malware that's immediately going to switch that address right as you hit send. But by having a whitelisted system and a very proprietary way of two-factor authentication for every transaction, suddenly it made transacting crypto safe. And it was like, oh my God, I can finally do business. But what is it going to take for the rest of the world to be able to transact crypto safely for their payments? What are some of the things you guys are building at Fireblocks now to enable this, not just for big institutions and banks, but for everyone?
That's a good question.
Right. Yeah, it's a very, very broad question. And I think there's no, you know, there's obviously not no one answer to this, but I feel I probably share the same vision as you guys have that, you know, if we go 20, 30 years in the future, everyone, every business, every individual would probably be running their financials over digital rails. And it doesn't matter if you are a bank or you're a fintech app or, and you probably won't even think about like, where is my money? Is it on the blockchain or not? Like your bank account would run on this, right? Your whatever favorite app to transfer funds between friends would run on this, right? The real question is to me, how do we in Fireblocks build the best platform and infrastructure so that every business in the future, once they slowly realize and mature to that point, could run their business on Fireblocks? And I'll try to explain this maybe a bit better. I think we're still missing a lot of enablers in our space, right? And again, I'm not going to say the obvious, which is, you know, poor UI, poor user experience. Fine. Yeah. You know, that. Guess what? It's not going to get solved anywhere in the next, you know, I don't know, 2 years, because it doesn't need to get solved that way. I'm not sure that a better, nicer iPhone app would make it easier for people. There are great apps in crypto, right? Very comfortable apps. Zengo as a private wallet, by the way. Like, I love that wallet. But look, I think that I'll give you an example. This, as soon as we have on-chain identity, for instance, you unlock billions of users who a lot of countries are not allowing them to participate in this because the businesses can't really rely on their virtual identity that is not attested by anyone, right? And we already have on-chain identity projects running, which are very cool projects like Verity by Circle and Coinbase or Shift, another great company, or I think Hedera Hashgraph are also running their own on-chain identity projects. So this is one enabler. Another enabler is, I believe it's stablecoins, right? I think that we've seen this with USDC and now maybe Eurocoin, maybe that would replicate that success. But the matter of fact is no one cares about USDC or Eurocoin. And I'm not saying that because it's a bad product, not at all. I'm saying it's an amazing product. I think Circle is an amazing company as well for running that. But I think that is a patch between today and until the moment that financial institutions that you normally interact with will also introduce stablecoins. I can tell you that Fireblocks is currently working with more than 20 financial institutions worldwide to issue stablecoins. And for those could be banks or other fintechs, but the best example would be in Brazil. The government decided, you know what, CBDC, that's not really going anywhere. How about we put a framework for stablecoins and have the banks issue stablecoins? And they did that. And now every bank in Brazil is running to issue a stablecoin, which would be interoperable, by the way, because it was a framework by the government between all the banks. But maybe in Brazil, in 2 years, everyone would be running on digital rails. That's exciting. That would be, I believe, a huge enabler alongside other enablers like on-chain and other things for bigger and better adoption. And again, I'll say just the final sentence. The moment people obviously wouldn't have to give this second thought is the moment that we know it has been mainstream, right?
Yeah, once it kind of becomes like just oxygen. You know, it's just there. You don't think about it. It's just part and parcel of everyday sort of transactions. And it's kind of, you know, interesting because the world really will moving all of its, you know, sort of industries of value digitally, right? Like we already had music and media that was digitized and that kind of got, you know, rid of the monopolies with the big, you know, media companies, the record companies, the telecoms, all that kind of stuff. And now what we're seeing is, you know, a very similar sort of transition here where, you know, now the physical banks and the physical producers of cash and stuff are now going to get supplanted by, you know, these digital decentralized banks. And so do you think, like, you know, tell me a little bit about, you know, how much you think that this is going to, you know, kind of impact us? Because I saw recently that even in Israel, it's like they're trying to get folks to not use cash at all. There was some, you know, thing was like, we're going to limit the amount of cash you could physically use to some, you know, small number. Is this transition like happening before our very eyes?
So it's interesting that in the last year, just when maybe even, I don't know if it was like coordinated by them, but just as the crash of crypto really started and got momentum, it's like at that, for some reason, at that point, a lot of banks have started to feel, I would say, more ready to get on this adventure. And I don't think, obviously, it's not really related to the crash, but it's more related to a lot of other things that did happen. And I think it really relates to what COVID created, right? The lack of need for us to use cash due to COVID and e-payments and everything. That really drove, I think, a lot of those financial institutions to start thinking of this. And if you would tell me a year ago that we would be working with 20 banks to issue stable coins and create other sorts of products, I will tell you you're crazy. Because let's be honest here, you've been in crypto for a long time. In 2017, we said institutions are coming. In 2018, we said, no, now they're really coming. In 2019 and 20,
year after year, 2021.
We said they're coming and, you know, they never showed up, right? We had like Fidelity. We thought, okay, after Fidelity, everyone's going to show, right? But no one showed. And we just need to face it that this is going to take a long time, but it is happening, you know, right now in front of our eyes, but it will take time. What's interesting to me, the question I'm asking a lot of the times is, would banks that are not adopting this right now or in the next 2-3 years, will they become extinct? Is this like an extinction event, like, you know, dinosaur extinction event for banks, that either you jump on this wagon or you literally lose all your clients because you're not connected to this new payment system, or you're not allowing 24/7 transactions and all the amazing features blockchain will allow you, or not? That's a question I'm thinking about constantly.
I think that's exactly the right question. It's that, you know, banks are going to be forced to adapt. You know, it's like adapt or die. Just in the same way that, like, you know, once Netflix first started out and they were just mailing DVDs, you know, to people. And then the internet happened and YouTube happened and they were like, oh my gosh, now people could just stream things immediately. So we need to adapt or die. Right, we need to make sure that we have, you know, all the APIs and the WebSockets enabled so that we could get, you know, 4K video. They have all their CDNs like directly into the house with like low latency. And so it's like, that's maybe not a huge, you know, capital expenditure they wanted to undergo at the time, but they were forced to. And I think banks around the world are going to be faced with the same thing, because they will be, you know, having their lunch money taken by the Coinbases and the FTXs and the Binances of the world. And then they're going to say, okay, well, we got to do this. But what I am kind of, you know, picking up a little bit from at least our conversation here is that it might be some of the developing worlds to take action quicker, at least on the governmental level and the institutional level. Like I'm hearing, you know, you drop, you know, Bank of, you know, Brazil, 20 of these banks more in developing worlds, that might be a little bit more appetized, if you will, for this kind of technology. Not, you know, it's you know, I don't know why it might be. It's maybe because the first world, like the West, right, really is the incumbent. They don't want to be disrupted. Hey, if you're in charge, why do you want to have, you know, a disruptive force here? So do you kind of see it unfolding like that, whereby, you know, some of the developing world will kind of glob onto this technology a little bit more and it's going to spread that way? And then eventually kind of the Western banks are going to be open to it?
100%. I mean, again, I think that we've seen this in telecommunications, right? Countries have skipped landlines and jumped to mobile. Some countries have skipped desktop computers and, you know, just jumped to smartphones.
Totally.
Or phablets, or when was that happened, right? So I really look at that as the same thing that will just happen in financial infrastructure, which is eventually the next step right now is blockchain. And if, I don't know how many people know that, but in Brazil, up until 2 years ago, and it still happens now, but this was like in 2 years ago, this was 100% of the cases. If you would order something from Amazon, then you would go on Amazon, you would complete your purchase, you would get a slip, and you would go with that slip to like 7-Eleven, and you would pay with that slip. And only once that happened, Amazon would get notified that you have paid for the product because no one had a credit card, right? And then they would ship you the product, right? Wow. And that's just so surreal for us in the West, right? What do you mean? Like, I just click pay now. What do you mean, right? And now they've created a stablecoin infrastructure, and within 2 years, the country would run on stablecoins, right? So they're skipping cards, they're skipping, I don't know, like even PSD2 and bank to bank transfers, right? Like they're skipping all of that, and they're going to jump to amazing financial rates. And I think that's going to happen in a lot of countries because they have more motivation right now. They're let's call that their tech debt. In terms of financial infrastructure is just so big. It just makes no sense to move to whatever we use today, right? I don't know if you know what you use today in your bank. I can tell you that most banks that I get to meet with, they tell us, you have to help us. We are running on mainframes from the 60s.
Oh yeah.
The reason that your funds are transferred within 2-3 days, a major part of that is that those systems that are so antique that we literally have someone who we're grateful that he's still alive, that he can come and fix bugs for us.
I was just going to say, I was speaking in Cleveland at this conference called Blockland, and there was, you know, dozens of these banks, right? And, you know, they told me, they're like, by the way, we are still running COBOL. And he goes, we are in a serious problem. And again, not like an age discriminatory thing, but they were like, our developers that know COBOL are aging out of the workforce because COBOL is such an old, archaic language from, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. It's like basic, right? Like now nobody teaches that in school. Like you literally got to go back and find a library book that teaches you this stuff. And so it's a big problem.
You gotta have a time machine. You need a time machine. You go back in time, you learn COBOL. It's a whole thing, right? You can't just do that.
And what's interesting is that, you know, we are now getting to the point where they're going to have to retire those sort of systems. And there's now a ripe opportunity for new technology. Let's take the quantum shift. We're going to go from COBOL to blank, right? I mean, how do we finish that sentence? We're going to go from COBOL to blank.
No, I agree with you altogether. And I think, again, just going back to what I said before, I think it's just easier for them because mostly those developing countries, they're more, let's say, in the West, we've built such complicated frameworks, even from a legal perspective and from a regulatory perspective, that for us to introduce new payment systems, it's a pain. And blockchain is this new payment system for transfer of value for a lot of different things, but it's a pain. And for in developing countries, it's just a smoother process in a lot of different ways, right? And they're more keen to, if you guys remember back in 2017-18, the first countries that offered licenses in crypto for crypto businesses were Gibraltar and Malta And I don't recall the third country. I think it was either something in the Caymans or Bahamas, but it was countries that, you know, they need companies to come in, set up base, pay taxes, and you know, create more GDP essentially in this country. And what's better than make sure we're first in line for offering licenses, right? But obviously, eventually, everyone had to go and do the MTL licenses or BIT licenses for crypto in the US or whatever licenses like e-money, et cetera, financial institutions in Europe or Singapore. But those countries were so quick to respond because they can. Right, they can create a new framework for that. They can introduce new bills quickly without the House, the Senate, you know, the Hill, everything. Like, I'm sorry, I'm from Israel. I don't even understand how you do that. But what I'm saying is, it's just easier for them. And hopefully, they will be our flashlight on showing how it's done and how to implement those. And the West will learn from that, and over time, will adopt that as well.
That's so fascinating. So in this growing industry of stable coins, whether it's USDC over like 8 different blockchains or bank specific stable coins over the Quant network or something completely brand new, there was once a pesky little guy named Bitcoin who was supposed to solve all this. What is the end game for Bitcoin in the light of all these other directions?
That is a question that I definitely have a view on, but it constantly fascinates me as well. I think Bitcoin is really, I'll say something that's very unpopular. I think Bitcoin is actually has done its job, really. That being said, it will never go away. Now, I don't see how it goes away anymore. The reason I'm saying it's done its job is that, you know, when our good friend Satoshi released that white paper of a peer-to-peer system and wrote very elegantly 11 pages. And by the way, if everyone's listening and you haven't read that white paper, trust me, I wouldn't say it's easy reading material, but putting aside the mathematical formulas, then it's an easy material to read. So read it. But when he put that out, he or she, no one even knows, then it was a very elegant peer-to-peer payment system that solved some, you know, the double spending issues and how we were doing this decentralized way. And that was amazing. That was literally a moment in time that we will look back probably 100 years from now and say, you know, thank you. That was like the real wheel reinvented, bread sliced, whatever. But, and then, you know, and then Ethereum came and I believe, you know, upgraded that and smart contracts and having the ability to constantly run a machine worldwide that's on a contract that is decentralized. And then greed came and ICOs and a lot of like humanity found out about blockchain, right? and all that happened. But and I think that now there are just far more, I believe, advanced systems than Bitcoin. That being said, over the period of the last, you know, 12 years, probably 12, 13 years, Bitcoin has taken a role of like this index of the industry, if you will. And you know, I've been told by people younger than me who call me a boomer that it is digital gold. And I know younger people than them that say they are boomers that say, well, you know, Bitcoin is dead. It's all about Dogecoin right now. But what I'm saying is I think Bitcoin's role right now in our lives is more, again, an index or something that tells us where the industry is right now. And I will tell you personally, and obviously this is not an investment advice, I think it's an amazing platform. It's an amazing system, Bitcoin. It's an amazing blockchain as well. Obviously, with Lightning, there's a lot of amazing things you can do with that. I still believe there are other better blockchains. Am I a hodler of Bitcoin and will accumulate every time I think there's a dip, as declared by the president of, I forgot the name of the country, that El every Salvador. Time there's a dip, he buys more. El Salvador, thank you. Yes, I will buy that dip. Probably, because I do love Bitcoin. I do believe in Bitcoin. I do think that that, you know, the upside is of this entire industry is ahead of us, right? Not just Bitcoin. But that being said, I think its role in the world is maybe done. I know that Jack Dorsey doesn't agree, and he's a smarter fella, so listen to him.
Yeah, no, there's lots of opinions, and we're in the middle of it right now. And who knows how the war is going to end, how the battle will end. And I think that, you know, that's what just makes this just the most exciting time to be in roles like we both have, you know, being able to talk to industry experts, see, you know, what the consensus is. And I think really one of the consensuses that I've picked up on is that, you know, Bitcoin is the largest in terms of market cap. It is the largest in terms of brand recognition, maybe even security, some might say, just in terms of the hashing power directed behind it and all that stuff. But its very role as the number one already is its growth potential is limited. So people say, oh, well, you know, it's, you know, I'm not going to buy that for my 100x gain anymore. I need to buy something smaller cap, something newer. And then at the same time, that sort of mentality is reinforced because Bitcoin's very, very, very slow to upgrade its network. It has kind of archaic cryptography compared to some of the, you know, the zero knowledge cryptography that's coming out, the privacy preserving aspects, the smart contracting, all that kind of stuff, like, doesn't necessarily exist on Bitcoin. So people say, well, maybe it's reached its potential. You know, maybe, right? And there's other opportunities out there. There's newer technology. And so it's going to be interesting to see because, of course, there's the Bitcoin maxi camp that just scoffs. And we've had plenty of those folks on the podcast before. And they're very interesting, but they come from a different world, right? They come from a world of, you know, Austrian economics is what they call it, basically. Just saying that all the problems in the world are attributable to, you know, Keynesian economics and inflationary monetary supply and governments that could, you know, finance themselves at the, you know, kind of the expense of the people through the Federal Reserve and all this kind of stuff, borrowing from future generations. And they say, you don't get it, Bryce. You're thinking too small. This isn't about the technology. Come on. This is about the ethos and the philosophy behind new money. What do you say to those guys?
You know, I root for them. I would tell them, you know, I don't know if I'm right or wrong. I'm a Ray Dalio fan.
Okay? Ray Dalio,
and,
okay, yeah.
And Ray Dalio has this very interesting theory of, you know, how the world works and empires rise and fall and large cycles, etc. And if you've never read or seen any YouTube clips of Ray Dalio, look at one, The New World Order. It's actually a very interesting one. It's not that new anymore. I think it's like a year old. And he shows how over the last, you know, 2000 years, we've had empires that come and go. And the empires come and go because there's this build cycle where they create efficient economic incentives for their population, and they invest in education and they invest in workforce, and slowly that empire becomes one who has the world reserve currency, whether, by the way, that is actual silver coins or the Dutch gulden a few hundred years ago, or after that the pound, and now the dollar, right? So he shows how that comes and goes and how empires rise and fall and how they usually overstretch, and that causes their failures. And I tried in the last, in the last few weeks, I've listened to that again. I've tried to understand what's Bitcoin's role in that, right? Does that break that cycle of debt and everything? Like, will humanity actually, exactly like you said, Bryce, would humanity finally adopt a system that's non-inflationary and has a finite number of tokens in it for its economics, et cetera? And my conclusion, and maybe I'm not optimistic enough about the human race, is that it's not gonna happen so quickly because there are so many, like, the world runs on money. There are so many economical motivations, incentives for people, for governments, for countries, for individuals, for entities, for everything, that I find it very hard to see how that new type of money comes in and we replace everything and that just fixes everything. I just find that hard to believe it will happen because I think humanity's nature that over the past thousands of years have just been not replaying itself, but, you know, rhyme, history rhymes, right? So just doing the same things over and over, I fail to see how Bitcoin fixes that. You know, maybe a very good shrink for the entire human race could fix that, but that failed right now. But it doesn't mean that I don't believe in Bitcoin. I still believe that Bitcoin is something that every new person coming into crypto, you know, I would tell every friend, you know, you should go open a wallet, buy Bitcoin. It's the best currency to start with. You will understand how crypto works. You will be amazed after you do your first transfer. And that is the best, maybe that's its role. And again, this is why it will become an indice over years, because billions will get into this industry and they'll buy crypto. But I don't buy the maximalist theory, unfortunately. I hope you don't get thrown nasty emails after being a podcast and say that.
That's okay. We get it just for talking about more than Bitcoin on this show, but we don't care.
Why it's called Crypto 101 and not Bitcoin 101. We think This is a lot bigger than just, you know, one blockchain.
It is. It absolutely is. Now, of all the clutter on my desk, I don't have a crystal ball. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, history often rhymes. And I think the next note that Bitcoin's going to play in its dialogue is going to be a store of energy. It originally was supposed to be electronic cash, but it's too slow to do that these days. And then it was supposed to be a store of value, but we see that even in inflationary conditions, it's still not holding or increasing its value. So that narrative's out the window. But being here in Texas, the energy capital of North America, I've been able to see some things and talk to some people that have a different take on it. And there's conventions now just about putting more Bitcoin mining here in Texas, just as a way of absorbing all the excess energy that's created here, because there's not enough batteries. So people are trying to hook up mining rigs to natural gas plumes and fracking wells just to say, well, if I don't have someone to sell this energy to, we can at least convert it into Bitcoin and then we can sell the Bitcoin. And, you know, we just saw our very, very first experiment in a stablecoin backed by Bitcoin, where, you know, everyone wants, you know, some kind of money, but it needs to be backed by something. We don't want a piece of paper that's not backed by gold or a military or a planet made out of diamond, something. So I think we could potentially see more stablecoins that are backed by Bitcoin in the future as Bitcoin does stabilize itself, potentially as an index of the industry, as a more tightly correlated price towards the cost to produce it. And it acts as a storage of energy. What do you think about that potential narrative?
I actually think that's fascinating. The first question, obviously, is why don't you connect your surplus of energy to California's lack of energy? Because I've heard people are going to be using bicycles instead of their electric cars.
It's all politics over there. It's not that it can't be connected. It's just the contracts that would allow that have been messed up for decades.
Okay. All right. I don't understand a lot about American politics, fortunately, but let me, you know, I can try to use my crystal ball, right?
I think that's an awesome looking crystal ball for everybody who's not watching on YouTube, but just listening. They can't see that he just turned himself into a crystal ball.
Yeah. Well, you know, I try to stay hip and do, you know, what the kids do. And obviously, it's not just one trick that I have out of my hat here. But, you know, don't think I'm an alien or something. So again, let's go back to the podcast. What I'm saying is that your take on would Bitcoin be a store of energy, it's actually interesting, because if that is true, then that wouldn't that cause a lot of other countries to try to do the same experiment and would create like a ton of hash power, and actually, I'm just trying to think out loud, would actually reduce the incentives for the entire Bitcoin mining, you know, participants. And that maybe would just hurt that cause. I don't know. That's something I need to ponder about. That's actually an interesting point you made there, Aaron.
Well, the thing is, most places are importers of energy. And like California, Europe especially right now, and California is an importer. Europe is a huge importer, and they're starving for more of that energy. But there aren't the rails to really deliver that, or the political agreements to deliver that in an efficient way across the world. Texas just happens to be one of these surplus places that has flares burning 24/7, polluting the atmosphere because there's nothing connected to the other end of this gas line. But you could connect that to a motor that powers all kinds of Bitcoin miners, and that creates another revenue and cleans up the environment. Same goes for Russia and many other places in Asia that are big producers, but just don't have the rails or the political ties to efficiently make sure that every little kilowatt of electricity is used properly. There's just a tremendous amount of waste. And I think Bitcoin mining could at least be a stopgap measure for that, until the next narrative comes along.
No, that's interesting. And I have to say, for a minute there, it sounded like an Adam Neumann company. But it doesn't mean it's a bad thing. But
and good ideas, just poor execution.
Man, no, this is good stuff. Goldie, you know, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that we cover some of the key points here about Fireblocks as they move into the new realm, right? What's on your roadmap? What are you guys pushing for? What's the big idea over the course of the next year or so?
Right. So there's four things that we're focusing on Fireblocks, let's say in the next year or so. And again, just to remind you, we're really thinking ourselves as how are we becoming the platform, the infrastructure, the OS for everything that wants to run on digital assets, doesn't matter what kind of business you are. And you know, I guess the best comparison for that would be, I don't know, maybe I don't want to sound too antique, but maybe SAP or any other system that is really just everywhere, right? And it just runs the infrastructure that you work with. But in the next year, I think we're highly focused on, I would say, four segments, really. The first one is our, you know, bread and butter, which are the crypto natives. Everyone who's doing anything that's a treasury use case, a trading use case, those are, you know, that's where we came from. Those are that's the industry that we feel probably most connected and affiliated with. There's a lot of things that we can improve in our product. Still, it exists for 4 years. Yes, you guys said you love it. That's amazing. But as you also know, crypto doesn't stop, and you need to continue and evolve and improve. And there's a lot for us to do there. The second segment that we're focusing on is Web3. I'll include Web3 and DeFi in that. There's a surge that I don't think it's a hype. I think decentralized companies or Web3 companies are, and definitely DeFi, I think it's so innovative that it's even hard for us to capture how innovative it is most of the time. And I think it makes sense for us as Fireblocks to invest in that. And by the way, I can just being honest, I don't think that would bring, as a company, obviously we are for profit. I don't think Web3 and DeFi in the next 2 years will bring the same type of revenue we have from other segments, but I think it's worth investing. And I think everyone in the company believes in that as well. And the other two segments,
that's good to hear.
One is TradFi. Which is, again, the banks are waking up, they're coming to us, and we want to be there for them to take them to the next step. It's not easy work to work with a bank. Luckily, the company, you know, it's interesting because if 20 banks would come to us 3 years ago when we were, I don't know how many, like 30 people, we wouldn't be able to do that. Now that we're almost 600 people and we're an $8 billion company and we have a lot of resources, yes, we can do that with banks, with, you know, we've, as you know, Bank of New York Mellon invested in Fireblocks and planning to launch this and a lot of others. Yeah. And we're working with them and mostly focusing on tokenization, by the way, which is good because banks used to come to crypto companies and would say, explain to me this technology, what can I do with that? Now they already know what they want, okay, which is a good change. And the last but not least is payments, and which is what I lead. And this is working with companies like Stripe, like Checkout.com or Worldpay. And again, PSPs, that's the type of companies we're looking for. And we've already declared some great partnerships. And we want to make sure that there's 175,000 payment companies in the world. They help you today move money from one pocket to another, whether if you're paying to a merchant offline or online, or it's a B2B or invoice payments or whatever, you're using a payment company, one of those 175,000 companies worldwide. We want those companies to continue to do whatever they're doing best, but just run that on digital rails. And we're here to give you an engine to do that. So that's those are like our four focus areas. I imagine our CEO, if you've ever met him, has probably like 10 other focus areas he wants to do, Michael Shalov, but we've forced him to choose four. And hopefully if we do another interview a year from now, I'll tell you if, you know, if that worked or not and what's the next focus.
We'd love to have you back on in another year, Goldie. But we're going to let you go.
6 months.
6 months, even. Anytime you want to come back, happy to have a conversation on or off the record. Just a couple more questions before we let you get back to building the future. You know, who's one person in this space that really inspires you to do what you do, to not have a life, to give everything you have to Fireblocks and crypto and the future of finance?
Well, there's you might make fun of that, but in this space, one of my favorite people is actually Mike Novogratz.
Mike Novogratz, I don't know if you've
it's surprising because, you know, my favorite person, Mike Novogratz, might not have I might not love every attribute about him, but if you've ever got to know his story, growing up in this, you know, seven siblings family, like mom, that he laughs about it, like I gave him some tough love, and a dad who was in the army, and out of that, all the brothers helped and sisters helped each other, you know, to grow and to evolve and to become these entrepreneurs and did amazing stuff. And he literally drips of greed, right? Like he doesn't stop. The guy is a billionaire. Just go to the beach, have a beer, take some time off. No, he starts Galaxy, right? So, and he lectures everyone in the world about how crypto is amazing. And I think that is, that keeps me going. I'm like, okay, if Mike doesn't stop, I can't stop.
And we all need to have, you know, role models and influencers sort of in our personal life like that. So yeah, Mike Novogratz, a huge, huge figurehead in the space. Also notorious for getting Luna tattooed on his body just months before the unwind and the crash. But hey, he owned it. I saw him tweet about it. He said, this was a lesson for me.
Oh yeah, never get drunk and go to a tattoo parlor, right?
Goldie, before we let you go, one other company in the crypto space outside of Fireblocks, or you could say maybe outside of anybody that you've got affiliations with, what's one other company that you think is having a fantastic impact on the future of finance here?
That's tough because I always, you know, I get to ask that question from time to time, even sometimes by VCs who ask me, like, what do you see? What are the most interesting companies in this space?
Yeah.
I think one company that is doing great work, but I wanted to succeed more, and I'm not affiliated with that at all, but I did say their name earlier, is Zengo. I know you guys are affiliated with them, but I think they're doing great work, and I think that I wish they would succeed even more than what they are right now, because I think they're helping users to get on board. And I think, you know, it would make you laugh, but I think the other company is actually a Fireblocks competitor, and that company is Gnosis. Gnosis Safe, their product. So I think, you know, if Fireblocks is more of this type of, you know, you want to build, there's like Robinhood runs on Fireblocks, Revolut runs on Fireblocks, great. But if you're just maybe starting like to play around with an app and you want to have like this open source, very quick, down and dirty, I want to see how custody really works. I want to build something on this. And at that, maybe I don't want to call Fireblocks right now and get a sales quote, right? Maybe that, then I want to go and I want to test it, and I can do that with Gnosis. And I think that's great. I think they're doing way better every day, and we actually cheer for them. So, because it helps us, people use them, come to us as they mature, we love it.
Yeah, the Gnosis Safe. I know that they've got some really interesting technology Ticker symbol GNO. If you guys want to check that one out on CoinMarketCap or whatever, if they've been around for a long time. So that's a throwback. And it's good to hear that they're still actively developing, and not only developing, but developing something that sounds pretty compelling. So Goldie, thank you so much for your time, for staying up late for us. I know you're over in a completely different time zone. So we're going to let you wrap things up at the office. And again, just can't thank you enough and hope to have you back on soon.
I had a great time. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Bryce. Hope to see you guys again and hopefully in real life.
Yes, that'd be great. That'd be great. Take care.
What's the difference between DIY and doing it yourself? It's the difference between a part-time passion and a full-time business. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker with a website that fits your unique vision and the business tools you need to succeed. Let your ideas flow with AI that guides you but keeps you in the driver's seat. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Do it yourself. Go to Wix.com.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.